problem of the kenosis, the self-empty, and then the 10 answers that are given to the question of what did Christ empty himself, that is trying to unpack this verb kenao. What did he empty himself? Now, I've taken the liberty of taking these 10 answers, I think this will be helpful to you, of taking these 10 answers, putting them down on one sheet, and then giving a brief critique of each answer, which boils down the material. Sometimes you have a whole page of material on one answer. So I've boiled it down to try to get at the heart of it, the core of it, the essence of it. So I hope this will be helpful to you. Now remember, saw a tape for Sean. Now once again, you've read through all these answers. And now you have a brief summation of them. The 10th one, I'm still, you see, struggling to express it. And I've expressed it in different ways. He left, now see, somebody's going to object to this immediately. He left his glorious residence in heaven and made his residence on earth. Somebody will say, hey, wait a minute. I'm the presence. Come on. You know, it's interesting that the dispensationalist writers of the late 19th century were very careful to distinguish between presence and residence. They said God is omnipresent, present everywhere, but makes his residence or his abode in heaven. Now again, you can't sort that out in terms of presence because he's omnipresent. Do you understand? So you've got to be saying, well, residence in heaven must mean some sort of special manifestation there. You have to try to sort that out. Divested himself of the outward trappings of sovereign majesty. Think, if you will, for a very imperfect analogy of the prince and the pauper. Okay? Restricted the use of divine power to that which was absolutely necessary to fulfill his mission. What a temptation to use divine power to benefit himself personally. And took the way of humiliation and service all the way to Golgotha in order to accomplish redemption for sinful human beings and to finish the Father's work. So you see, once again, I'm struggling for ways to say it. Just as I was with the bigger answer on page 53 and 54. Scott.
One problem I noticed, I'm not sure how it would be dealt with, but at the end of the 8th answer,
yes.
When you discussed it, you said the last sentence, however, veiling his glory in a relative sense and emptying himself of it are two quite different things. And then you go on in your answer 10, they use the word veil.
Yes.
So, well, in a relative sense, you said a partial veiling. So, there's just kind of a conflict there, and you kind of rejected it up above because...
Well, I rejected in 8 because of the way it's answered on page 52. He emptied himself of the glory which he had. I say a partial veiling of the glory, that could be acceptable. But a total emptying of the glory, that's unacceptable. Okay? See, that's what I'm getting at there. In other words, I'm saying veiling his glory in a relative sense, that would be acceptable. But emptying himself of it, that's a different thing entirely.
I understood that. I thought you were trying to say that the verse itself requires something either all or nothing.
No. Thank you. Thank you. I hope this sheet is helpful to you. Do you have questions on the exegesis of the passage, Philippians 2, 5 through 11, which starts on 47, continues on 48, and then breaks and finishes on 54. 47, 48, and then jumps to 54. And really doesn't develop verses 9 through 11 because that's the exaltation part, and we're really talking about the kenosis. So that really isn't a crucial part of the kenosis unless you buy into the kenosis theory. Then it becomes an important part. Any questions on that? All right. Page 54 at the bottom, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, and 61 speak of the offices of Christ, or the threefold office of Christ, if you wish. Some use the word singularly, but I suspect they use it collectively, because then they break it down and speak of his office as prophet, his office as king, his office as priest. So whether you talk about three offices or a threefold office, that's a stylistic difference. Do you notice on page 57 at the bottom and page 58 at the top, it speaks of the aspects of the office of prophet? Types, pointing to Christ, ceremonies prefiguring Christ, Christophanies, then during his earthly ministry, incarnation, his teachings, example, his miracles, his death, resurrection, ascension, then during his session in heaven. Question, Greg.
Yes.
Then Scott.
Ceremonies prefiguring Christ, as I wasn't quite sure which ceremonies you're referring to.
I was thinking of sacrifices which have teaching significance.
This is the office of prophet.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking so much of the sacrifices as being temporary adumbrations of the one perfect sacrifice in terms of the atoning work. I was thinking more of the teaching significances of the ceremonies. Scott and then Gwen.
One thing then I noticed here, you, during Christ's earthly ministry, you talk about his teaching, an example.
Yes.
And during session heaven, you talk about his teaching through his apostles and disciples.
Yes.
So I was wondering, should not maybe during the Old Testament period, since Christ is the Logos of God, should not his teaching through the prophets be included in there as part of his work as the office of prophet?
That's very possible. It's not usually included, but it's very possible to do that, especially as you sort out the role that each of the members of the Godhead carry out in fulfillment of the plan and purpose of God. But then, Scott, you have to bring in the Holy Spirit there, too. And for some, that creates rather difficult problems. You'd have to watch what you did with that until you moved to the Holy Spirit and worked on that part, and then said, uh-oh, wait a minute, maybe I have to back off. And if you back off there, you may have to back off on the other one somewhat.
But I'm not taking the idea of the Logos of God in properly in thinking.
No, not at all. Not at all. Gwen.
Excuse me, but you had asked before about if there are any questions on page 54. You know, I'm a little slow to go off in time.
Uh-huh.
I did remember something that I did want to discuss. On page 54.
You have to keep the gun loose in your holster, okay?
I tried.
All right, okay, go ahead. All right.
But it did puzzle me as I read something.
Yes.
And it means that begins with a new sentence and being found in fashion. Here we have a completion of expression of what Kierkegaard calls the absolute paradox.
Yes.
Now, I'd like to discuss a little about, I'm confused, if you have something that is called an absolute paradox, and verse 7 says, in the NIV, but being made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, and being made in human likeness. That's the NIV. I have a question then, if something is so profound, absolutely paradoxical, then I think, is it fair to say that two things can be derived from this? One is that it cannot even be discussed if it's an absolute paradox. And the second thing is, how do we draw an inference from something that is absolutely paradoxical? How can we discuss something that is absolutely paradoxical? And I have a problem understanding what that means, because Paul obviously uses this in everything he's written. He the basis of what he writes is all about Christ, you know, is throughout all the Gospels. And what John, what 1 John said is, you know, and we will see him because we will be like him. And that in my mind is, I mean, that speaks of his humanity,
yes,
as well as his exalted glory,
yes,
the human being as well as God. So my problem is, what does he mean by absolute paradox? I don't understand that, and I don't understand why he's putting it in the notes.
The absolute paradox to which Kierkegaard is referring is the fact that you have in one person both God and man. And you cannot reduce one to the other, either way, going from divine to human or human to divine. The problem there is, in discussing that, we can discuss it to the extent that we can at least state the paradox. As far as drawing implications from it, Kierkegaard uses, by way of an analogy from the Old Testament, Abraham. Feels that that's the most perfect analogy to the absolute paradox that we find in Christ. Abraham, on the one hand, is given a command to take his son and sacrifice him. That's a command. On the other hand, Abraham has a promise that through his seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And that seed, the chosen seed, is Isaac, not Ishmael, but Isaac. And Abraham knows that. So now you've got what Kierkegaard views as a supreme paradox. On the one hand, God commanding him to kill his son. On the other hand, God promising that through this very son, all the nations of the earth will be blessed and carry out the Abrahamic covenant.
But Kierkegaard's model does not use faith in what I would call the Reformed sense of faith. He would not work with faith in terms of a rational
no.
faith.
That's correct.
Well, I have a problem with this idea about the paradox. And the absolute paradox in my mind is how you can have illogical leap in faith.
Yes.
That's an absolute paradox in my mind.
Yes. The way he overcomes the paradox is through the leap of faith. The question might be, how would something like someone like R.C. Sproul overcome the paradox of the God-man? Now, when we talk paradox, Sproul would go out of his way, and some other writers recently would go out of their way, to try to point out that paradox is not logical contradiction. They would specifically go out of their way to do that. Now, for Kierkegaard, absolute paradox does have the value of contradiction. So he is using it in a way that goes beyond the way that word paradox is used in logic. And we could take issue with him on that point. But that you have a paradox, I personally think, is unquestionable. between, I mean, in one person being both God and man.
Yes, but the problem is he qualifies it by saying absolute.
I know that. I know that. But absolute only in the sense that, and he capitalizes both words, only in the sense that there is an absolute qualitative difference between God and man. It's that that causes him to put the word absolute in front of paradox. And we would try and have tried to preserve the creator-creature distinction as being absolute, not being quantitatively different, God and man, quantitative, but qualitatively different. The problem is he overcomes it with a leap of faith, which is a risk, which is really risking on the basis of an absurdity, rationally, that is. We're not proposing that at all here. I suggest here that we have the completion of expression of what he called the absolute paradox, the God-man. I'm not suggesting that we're overcoming that paradox with a leap. And I am drawing implications, and I am talking about it. So, I mean, I would reject Kierkegaard's formulation of faith and how to resolve the paradox. But I would preserve the paradox.
I don't have a problem with paradox in general.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Okay.
But I have a problem in his scheme of what a paradox is.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you very much.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay. Bill.
On top of page 58, you mentioned during Christ's earthly ministry some various works, and the one is that the miracles, which are signs, and then you make a specific note to say not simply wonders, but signs. Are you saying there that the signs equal revelation? What I'm getting at is the line of reasoning that says that miracles, signs and wonders, that's just things that Christ and the apostles did and the prophets before them were able to function because revelation was not complete. So we won't see that anymore because revelation is complete.
Well, you could ask what signs mean. Both the Old Testament word "guth" and the New Testament word "semeion," as they're used in connection with miracles, and ask signs of what? What are they signs of? What were miracles intended to convey? If I say beyond simply wonder, beyond simply people saying ooh and ah, or something like that. You know, when you see fireworks, you say ooh and ah. Or when the magician does something particularly clever, you say, oh, how did he do that, Dad? You know. If they go beyond that, if they're signs of something and not the magician's cleverness, signs of something, you have to ask signs of what? Are they signs, that is, outward expressions, almost in the sense of symbols, in the proper sense of that word, that God is at work here at this point in time, space, history in a supernatural way? In that sense, there is a teaching value, and I'm using it in that sense. They can also be signs in the sense of authentications of a messenger and of his message. And I'm using it in that sense also. I'm not touching the question at this point as to continuing revelation. That's a separate issue altogether.
I know about that.
Yeah, okay.
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 You did see them in
Revelation. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Someone else had... Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Okay.
Someone else had a point. I missed... Who had a point? Stephen, did you have a point? No. Okay. On page 59, it begins Christ's office as, page 59, just above the middle, the aspects of the office of priest. Christ offered himself as a sacrifice for sin once for all, and he continually intercedes for his people. That's fairly simple and straightforward. Atoning work and intercession. Christ's office as king, there we come to page 61, Christ ruling now in his church. He rules in the invisible church as its Lord and head by ruling in the hearts of his people. He rules in the visible church as its king and head through its officers, regulations, and, that bad word, discipline. Bad word because it's ignored in so many churches or frowned upon. I think we need more of an emphasis on 2a2, Christ ruling in the visible church. And then, second, Christ will one day rule in his kingdom upon earth, both during the millennium and in the eternal state. Questions? Comments? Stephen, I knew there would come a question from Stephen. Yes?
In regards to dispensational models, who is Roman?
In the dispensational system, which is, I won't say essentially, but virtually essentially premillennial, okay? I don't know that you can say that dispensationalism inevitably, inexorably commits you to premillennialism. That used to be a cliche, but I'm not sure that can be said inexorably. But for the most part, dispensationalists are premillennialists. So Christ in the millennium rules upon earth. Question, who rules on earth now during the interim in the parenthesis, the church age? I think most millennialists, most dispensationalists would answer, in one sense, God rules in the universe in that he has total control over all events and all human beings. That is, for those who would extend the control to that extent. Some dispensationalists don't buy into that concept of God's overarching control of all events. They shrink from that. But they would say that Satan rules as far as world, cosmos, in the sense of the evil world system, and would distinguish that from the created world, the created universe. So that one and the same time, God rules, and Satan, now it's curious, but Satan rules under God in the evil world system. And in a very real sense, is subject to God, and of course rules temporarily, for a long stretch, but temporarily. So I think they would probably sort it out in that way. Now, you have a problem in that all souls belong to God. They're all his. The earth is the Lord's, the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell in it. But, on the other hand, Satan is there, and the unregenerate are spoken of as the children of the devil. They're spoken of as being energized by Satan. There's a lot of aspects like that in which he appears to have a fair amount of control over human beings. Again, you have to subsume that under God's control. And I think dispensationalists would do that. I know it makes a mixed picture. Then dispensationalists during the millennium would have Satan confined so that control over human beings is broken during that time. toward the end of it, he's released from that control, I mean, released from that restraint, and then goes out again to try to solicit to evil the people who are dwelling on the earth who are not believers. Other points? Other questions, comments? Well, thank you. If anyone would like to pay for his or her class notes, I would appreciate it.
Are you thrilled?
No. Not quite.
Fresh kid on the block. Can I meet with you today at 1? Are you going to be free? Since you're not... You might regret having told me what you did.
If it's open. I'll be leaving at 2, but if it's open.
Okay.
Yeah. Hi there. Go ahead.
Excuse me. Thanks. Glory and honor. I'm going to give you something. On the last question on that quiz, I listed, you know, things. Two ones about attributes and then glory and honor.
I have to see it.
What do you mean see?
Your sheet, your quiz.
Well, I mean, it's no different from what I just said.
Well, I'd still like to see it.
Okay.
I'd like to exegete it.
Okay, I'll bring it next time.
Okay, appreciate it.
One other thing I just thought about with Christ and his office as king. Sometimes we speak of Christ as, and we think of Christ's relation to culture as Christ reforming culture. That's what I was taught at college anyhow. I think there's real merit to that. Is there a sense in which he is king then ruling through his church to reform the culture, which may not be Christian in and of itself?
I would think that that's true as long as you also insert into that picture common grace.
Hmm.
With God using other means besides believers.
Right.
As far as restraining and so forth.
Restraining.
So I think you'd have to plug that in. But otherwise, I think...
But actually, though, restraining isn't the same as reforming.
No. That's correct.
Yeah.
But restraining may be necessary to the task of reforming.
Does the idea of reforming culture... In some ways, that almost sounds like a post-millennial view.
To some degree, but...
But it wouldn't necessarily have to be, would it?
No. In fact, I think you do have to ask, do Christians have any responsibility in that direction? Or should they just let the world go on its own way to destruction? Do they have any responsibility, as for instance in the secular human? That would certainly then have spin-offs in terms of culture.
Mm-hmm. Being active in government.
Sure, exactly.
And things like that, as well as being active in the arts. That's actually where it first came up with me.
Precisely. And in a number of critical areas, too, that are moral questions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Especially touchy questions right now.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Leroy.
Hi. I was wondering about the text, you know, where Christ doesn't know the day or the hour. We already have said, well, at least we said later after we got to that in the notes, that the Son is involved in the decrees. And so it seems to me that the Trinity, the fellowship of the Trinity, is deciding on things at some point in eternity past, on things that are going to happen. Oh, couldn't we say that certainly there are things that he has decreed before the foundation of the world, but couldn't we say that also that perhaps at that point in time that Godhead, when Christ said he did not know,
yes,
that the Trinity, the councils of the Trinity, had not at that point decided when would be the end, and that that's the reason the Son did not know, the Father alone, because there was not yet a agreement in their council. They had not yet entered into what would happen. And so the second person of the Trinity was, in that sense, ignorant of. Of where it was.
That's a possible scenario. I think that would require us to go back and look and ask what is included in the plan of God.
Mm-hmm.
Is it large brushstrokes? Is it details? Is it fine details? Is it everything? And then we'd have to ask, is the plan complete before creation ever begins? So I think those two questions would come into play. To what detail can you view the plan, and was it complete then? Are there corrections and modifications as you go along? But that gets into the question of omniscience. And that's a very tricky question. The philosophers are really working on that right now, and they're making some modifications of it.
Yeah, my mind is working a lot in that.
Is that right? Yeah?
Yeah. I'm really considering that.
Yeah, that's a very fruitful area right now in terms of the literature.
Yeah, who is it now? The Only Wise God. Dr. Dunbar mentioned that book. I glanced at it. I'm going to work through it a little more. But
yeah.
That doesn't quite hit on them.
That could be very fruitful, that area, for a thesis. Very fruitful. Because a lot of work's being done in it, so there's a lot of literature. There's a lot of research.
In philosophical circles outside of theology, are they working on that? I mean, I know process theology is not really Christian.
There's good work in philosophy being done on that,
Are you familiar with, do you have any handle on some of the literature that's involved in
that? Well, I see it here and there. I would have to, I wouldn't be able to pull it together at a moment's notice, but I could certainly suggest a couple articles, and their footnotes or endnotes or bibliographies could suggest other things, which would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I would be interested in that.
Okay, when I run across a couple of things, I'll keep you in mind.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
I'm glad you're interested in that area.
Yeah, it's very intriguing.
Oh, my.
It's very intriguing. There's a lot of... I've had a lot of implications to theology as well.
Thank you.
I will tell you that.
That is
that's in my notes. That's in my notes.
Now you're